gave him a hug. Love and unbridled anticipation are contagious in this way. Over the course of the next several dozen trips to the airport, I learned Patricia loved the house. Adrian had purchased it, and Patricia was on her way to move in. He beamed as he talked about what he'd accomplished. I was so proud of him. I felt like I was getting a house, too. What I liked about Adrian the most is he knew who he was. I was also struck by how authentic he was with his growing faith. Humble people don't fall for the lies pride tries to entice us with to fake it. After a particularly bad day, God's first words in the garden to Adam and Eve were simple ones. Where are you? It's the first post-screw-up conversation between God and the first family. God, of course, wasn't talking about geography when he asked the question, and he's not asking us about it now either. He hasn't lost track of the ones he created, and he hasn't lost track of you and me. Instead, I think God wanted Adam and Eve to figure out where they were with him after they failed. He's never stopped asking us the very same question. Where are you? To figure out where we are is to understand who we are. It's the question Adrian asks thousands of people every day. Who are you? A lot of us pretend we're at a different place in our faith than we really are. We pretend to be someone we're not, hoping we'll find more love or respect or popularity or get more attention. There usually isn't a bad motive underlying this. We do it because we're insecure or we're looking for approval or we're reaching for a way to connect with the people around us. Yet when what our faith looks like becomes more important than what it is, we've forgotten who we really are. God constantly allows things to happen in our lives that help us understand where we actually are with him and who we really are in the context of our circumstances. It's like he's checking our IDs every day. Not unlike what Adrian did at the airport. The thing about Adrian is he was never confused about his identity. He didn't have a Facebook page where he projected who he wished he was. I never saw him take a selfie. These aren't bad things, of course, but they can lead us away from ourselves. Adrian was just a guy who loved God, loved his family, and loved the next person who was standing in front of him. There's a benefit to knowing who we are. It helps the people around us. Let me tell you what I mean. When we're with a person who knows who they are, it allows us to take a breath and a second look at ourselves, too. People who have figured out who they are usually surround themselves with other authentic people who are figuring out who they are, too, rather than those who pretend to be someone they're not. One of the stories God tells in the Bible is much simpler than we sometimes make it. Jesus was with a few of his friends, and he asked them who people thought he was. These friends had heard several different stories about who Jesus was. One person said Jesus was really a man named John, who had been one of his friends. Another person said he was actually a person named Elijah, and someone else said he was somebody named Jeremiah. These two great men had lived much earlier. Jesus pressed his friends a little further and asked who they thought he was. It must have felt like a funny question for Jesus to ask his friends, who had been with him for a few years already. Peter spoke up first, and he said he thought Jesus was God. Jesus told him this wasn't the kind of thing Peter could have figured out just because someone told him what to think. Instead, he said it was something Peter would have only known because God told him. Jesus then told his friends something was even more puzzling. He told them not to tell anybody who he was. At first, this seems to go against the grain of the evangelistic model many of us have been exposed to, but I don't think he was trying to keep his identity a secret, just the opposite. Jesus probably wanted us to show people who he is by what we do, not just tell them what we think. I've been asking God to help me figure out who I really am and who he really is. Here's the thing. Jesus is the only one who can let us know the truth about ourselves and the truth about who he is. Most of us have all the information we need. God wants to use people like us to show the world what we know about Jesus in the way we love the people around us. I've sometimes thought I'd make a lousy evangelist because I don't think we lead people to Jesus. I think Jesus leads people to Jesus. Sure, we can tell the people we meet about Jesus. I talk about him all the time because my life is his, but I don't try to talk people into him. When I've tried and it's worked, What I've often found is I've led people to me, not him. If we take Jesus at his word, people won't know who Jesus is because we've told them. They'll know because Jesus let them know. If you're already friends with Jesus, don't get in everyone else's way as they figure it out with him. If you've only heard of him, ask him who he is. I bet he'll let you know. When Jesus invaded history, it's as if he stood at the front of a long line of people, everyone who ever has lived or will live. He asked all of us if we knew who we were, and he asked us who we thought he was. Some got it right and some didn't. The same is true today. I bet Jesus asked so many people about who they were and who they thought he was because there were as many people then as there are now who are confused about both. Our words say we're one person, but our lives say we're someone else. We do the same thing with Jesus. Some of us say he's God and we're following him, but then we live our lives like our ego is calling all the shots. The beautiful message of Jesus is his invitation to everyone that they can trade in who they used to be for who God sees them becoming. He said we can each get a new identity from him. The people who take him up on his offer begin to define success and failure the way he did. They move from merely identifying with someone's pain to standing with them in it, and from having a bunch of opinions to giving away love and grace freely. People who are becoming love make doing these things look effortless. With a new identity comes a new set of rules. It was a backwards economy Jesus talked about. He said if people wanted to be at the front of the line, they needed to go to the back. If they wanted to be a good leader, they would need to be an even better follower. If they wanted to know him better, they need to stop thinking so much about themselves. And if they wanted to love him more, they needed to love each other more. The last time I saw Adrian, we got some coffee and caught up. I told him I was going to be out of the country for a couple months. After a great conversation, we hugged, said our goodbyes, and he tapped a text message to each of my kids, telling them how much he loved them. Adrian didn't tell them about who they used to be. He told each of them who they were becoming. Every time we do this for one another, we reaffirm our true identities. When we draw a circle around the whole world like Grace did and say everybody is in, God's love gives us bigger identities than we used to have. With our newer, bigger identities, we can draw even bigger arcs around people's lives. We start to see our time here isn't meant to be spent forming opinions about the people we meet. It's an opportunity to draw the kinds of circles around them that Grace has drawn around us until everybody is on the inside. We don't decide who in line is in and who's out, and we don't need to waste any more time engaging in the kinds of arguments some people get sucked into. People who are becoming love don't swing at every pitch. We start by meeting people just 3 minutes at a time. Don't waste a minute of it arguing with people who are wrong. Quietly delight in the confidence that comes from finding truth in your own life. God never promised we'd have answers. What he offers to us is a box of crayons and the opportunity to let love draw bigger circles around the people we meet than they thought were possible. The call from Patricia about Adrian's death came as a shock to us all. Apparently, Adrian walked out of the airport after work and had a game-ending stroke in the parking lot. There was no warning and no reason. It just happened. I haven't tried to figure out why. Sometimes when we search too hard for explanations, we risk making them up by mistake. Our lives, our deaths, and everything in between aren't supposed to boil down to someone's guess about what it all means. No elevator speech can summarize who we really are or what we wanted most. Adrian's life was too special, too inexplicable for that. Everyone's life is. I'm confident God will fill in the spaces between the lines later. I've got quite a few questions. Perhaps that's why God made eternity last so long. He knew it would take a while to explain what he was doing. Before you decide why things have happened in your past or are happening now, wait for God to whisper the reasons to you. It'll be worth the wait. Adrian left behind Patricia and the rest of his family and friends, but he also left behind far more. He changed my perspective on what it takes to make a friend and to be a friend. You see, I used to think it would take a lifetime to become someone's friend, but now I think we do it just 3 minutes at a time. It's the way Jesus made friends with most of the people he met, and it's a great way for us to engage the people around us, including the ones we've been avoiding. I don't know what happens after we die. The Bible says to be apart from the body is to be present with God. Perhaps it happens in an instant, and maybe it's a little like the way it feels when you wake up from a nap. Either way, after Adrian died, I bet he opened his eyes and he was in heaven with Jesus. I don't know what heaven's going to look like, and I don't know if the roads are made of gold. Honestly, I kind of hope they're covered in Dippin' Dots. I don't know if we're going to be assembled in rows singing Chris Tomlin songs, but I kind of doubt it. I don't know about getting a set of wings either, but I'm crossing my fingers we don't. That might just be a guy thing. I don't know what color the gates of heaven are or who takes over when St. Peter takes a day off. But I wouldn't be surprised if there will be a long line of people waiting to get in. It will wind out the door like a long snake. Somewhere near the entry at the front of the line, I'm betting there'll be a guy who looks a lot like Adrian. He won't be checking for titles or degrees or accomplishments or how rich or poor someone is. He'll be asking everyone who they found their identity in, and if they really were who they said they were during their lives. Chapter 14, Carl's Dive. We're not held back by what we don't have, but by what we don't use. Carl was like most other kids in high school. He loved sports, and he was good at them, too. But he liked mischief even more, and he was even better at that. He and his friends would stare at the calendar, wishing their way through the spring to the summer and the chance to run wild together. Carl had a contagious charm and would quietly and unintentionally command the room when he bounced through the door. He was handsome, he was smart, and he had a well-earned reputation as a jokester. The next prank was always just around the corner for Carl and his buddies. Some people can juggle, others can tie a cherry stem in a knot with their tongue. Carl could hold his breath like a dolphin. He grew up on a lake in Illinois and would practice sinking in the water with his arms spread wide, no doubt hoping to score a rescue attempt and perhaps a mouth-to-mouth resuscitation from the cute girl who was a lifeguard on duty. It never really happened, but just the possibility made all the practice worth it. Each year, Carl and his buddies would head to a couple of lakes in Wisconsin for their summer adventures. They would float through the lazy summer days swimming, sailing, skipping rocks, and meeting the occasional girl or two who were also on vacation. Meeting girls, of course, trumped all the Huckleberry Finn stuff. One day, Carl was at his friend's house and saw two girls from his high school he wanted to both scare and impress sitting at the edge of the water. Carl thought it would take something big to wow them. He wanted to make an impression with some attention-getting bravado. He puffed out his chest and set off running towards the shore. His plan was to startle the girls by leaping over them and making a big splash in the water. Girls apparently dig that kind of stuff. His buddies were egging him on as he ran. When Carl got to the edge of the water, he leaped like he'd been shot out of a cannon. As he passed over the top of the girls, he gave a loud battle cry and looked down to see their faces. His head pointed him downward, and his body followed. Carl hit the water like a lawn dart and made a big splash. His buddies ran up to the girls as they giggled and offered them towels. The plan had worked perfectly. The girls looked over the edge of the dock into the murky water, anticipating Carl would come bursting out. As usual, Carl acted like a submarine just a foot under the surface of the water. He was pulling the trick he'd perfected in the local swimming pool lying still. As 1 minute passed, the girls' giggles faded into concern. Shouldn't we do something? Soon concern turned into panic. This wasn't funny any longer. Carl was still motionless below the surface. Even his buddies thought Carl was taking the stunt a little too far. They jumped feet first into the murky lake, and to their surprise, the water barely covered their knees. The water Carl jumped into headfirst was only 3 feet deep. One of his buddies grabbed Carl by the ankles while another one grabbed him by the shoulders. As they lifted Carl onto the dock, his neck flopped back like a rag doll. Fortunately, a paramedic lived across the street, and a friend who saw the commotion called for an ambulance. Carl was whisked away to the hospital. Spinal cords are tricky things. They're made up of a bundle of nerves that control most of our bodies. Our spinal cords control our sense of touch, how our arms and legs move, how our lungs work, and much more. When the spinal cord is injured, messages no longer get from the brain to the parts of our body below the injury. With any spinal cord injury, there's damage done immediately, and there's more damage as the injury begins to shut down other parts of the body. It's like a dangerous game of dominoes. The spinal cord is so specialized, it can't repair itself, and even the most skilled doctor can do very little to help. At the hospital, the doctors tried to assess the extent of Carl's injuries. They asked him if he knew where he was, who the president was, and what month Christmas was celebrated in. Carl could talk for the first 40 hours following the injury, but then he lost the ability to speak as his spinal cord continued to swell. He had many questions, but he'd been stripped of the ability to ask them. Carl felt as if he'd been padlocked inside his body. A nurse was busy in the room, and Carl had an idea. He couldn't speak, so he started spelling words by blinking at the nurse. One blink was an A, three blinks was a C, and so on. When can I walk? Carl blinked out the words to the nurse. She put down what she was working on, sadness sweeping across her face as she gently said, "Didn't the doctors tell you? You'll never be able to walk again, Carl. I'm so sorry." Her words hung in the room like a thick fog. Carl could feel the tears rolling from the corners of his eyes down to his ears. These were the only places he could still feel. As the weight of her words sank in, it was as if Carl was underwater once again, this time sinking very deep. The nurse came in close and wiped Carl's tears away as her own streamed down her cheeks. Carl then slowly blinked his next message to her. "When can I use my arms?" The nurse, still sitting on the bed, searched for words. "Carl, I'm so very sorry. You hit the bottom so hard. You'll never be able to use your arms again either." She stroked Carl's hair, trying to offer some comfort, but it didn't help. Carl's neck injury had been so massive, and his spinal cord was so damaged, the only things he would ever fully be able to use were his tongue, his eyes, and his mind. Carl stayed in the hospital for months. He had stabilized, and the doctors and nurses switched their attention to helping him function in his new reality. During that time, a special vehicle was built so Carl could have mobility. Because Carl had the use of his tongue, a straw was attached to the steering mechanism. Carl uses small puffs of air and his tongue to steer forward and backwards, to start, to stop, and turn. Carl was eventually discharged from the hospital. He had become used to the routine there and the relative comfort of learning his new life in a highly monitored environment. The discharge almost felt like he was being released to a prison as big as the whole world. He began figuring out things one by one all over again. The specialized steering unit was outfitted so Carl could answer the telephone, write emails, and do just about every other task the rest of us take for granted. Carl had to relearn how to navigate his entire life using just his tongue, his eyes, and his mind. Carl wasn't a quitter. Even though his body had been wrecked, he still had the spirit of a fighter and a prankster. He took up the challenge with gusto. After graduating from high school, Carl went to college. He had adjusted to his new life, but felt a growing vacuum deep inside of him. It wasn't just that he couldn't move any longer. He felt his whole life had lost any kind of trajectory. He didn't want his greatest achievements to be what he learned to do with a straw. He felt a growing need to find more meaning and purpose than his life had offered even before his injuries. During his freshman year, Carl met a couple of people who told him about a carpenter from Nazareth who had changed them. They were part of a campus group who got together every week, and they invited Carl to come to some of their meetings. What Carl found most compelling from where he sat was that this carpenter they talked about had navigated his entire life using only love. The Bible talks a lot about our tongues, our eyes, and our minds. It says we'll navigate much of our lives with them, just like Carl navigates his. Many of us have arms and feet we can move to help others, but we choose not to. We shy away from people we don't understand or who intimidate us because they're different from us. We have eyes to see people who are hurting, but we only watch because we're scared if we get closer, it will disrupt what we've spent a lifetime making orderly. We have minds to understand the depths of others' pain, but we just empathize in our own heads without getting involved because we're scared of what might happen if we do. Carl lost the ability to use his arms and legs, but he learned to overlook this as an impediment. Many of us are limited by what we have but don't use. Carl didn't want to be limited by what he had but couldn't use. Being stripped of so many capabilities, he was forced to go deeper and find something worth the chase. Carl put his trust in Jesus. Carl was convinced after reading the claims Jesus had made that he could actually change the world using only his tongue, his eyes, and his mind. Carl and I went to law school together. We met on the first day of class. He's a hard guy to miss in the hallway with a machine he used to get around. He was stunningly kind and smart and loving. What was most striking about him, though, was he found a freedom in his life most of us are still looking for in ours. Carl and I sat for the bar exam at the same time, and he finished before me. You know why? He's got a fast tongue. Since passing the bar on his first try, Carl's been working at the Attorney General's office. He chases bad guys for a living, running towards injustice with passion and purpose. His quick mind and even quicker tongue have proven to be more than enough for him to make his mark in the world, to do justice, and to express his love for God in many ways. Carl has had 5 cases go to California's Supreme Court. He won 5 times. Not only this, but he's had more than 100 published decisions that have shaped the laws on criminal justice and victims' rights affecting millions of people. Carl's life is not unlike the story of a young boy with a few fish and some bread. Jesus tells us to take what we have to him and he'll make something amazing out of it. Carl just keeps bringing what he's got to Jesus. I think we should do the same. We just keep bringing whatever we've got to God and let him decide what he'll do with it. When I think about Carl's fateful dive, I think about how his body followed his head. He looked down to wave at the girls, and his body went where his head was looking. This is how we're all wired. Where we turn our heads is where we'll land with our lives. It happens all the time with careers or relationships or possessions. It doesn't matter whether it's comparison or distraction or escape that turns our heads. What we look at will be the difference between a great dive and a big disaster. Most of us won't break our necks when we look or leap wrong, but we may do something equally crippling in a different way. We need to be careful where our minds dwell. Many of us dwell on what other people are thinking of us. It's easy to do. But we can be so busy trying to get the approval of others that we forget who Jesus said we are. Here's the problem. When we're busy getting our validation from the people around us, we stop looking for it from God. You'll know this is happening to you when you go with what's popular rather than what's eternal. When you settle for what feels good right now, rather than opting for what will make a good and lasting impact a decade from now. If we let our heads turn toward the shallow waters offered by wrong relationships, the rest of our lives will follow where our heads have gone. When we do, we'll crater instead of create, and we'll drown in the places we ought to be swimming. On our last day of law school, Carl said he was sending a car to pick up some friends and me. We climbed in and the car took us to a field north of San Diego. We didn't know what had been planned for us and a great deal of attention had been given to keeping the evening shrouded in secrecy. We guessed we were getting together with Carl to have a celebration picnic on the beach and to throw the frisbee around a little. Instead, when we were far enough north to turn left to the beach, we turned inland and an open field came into view. In the middle of the field stood a gigantic, colorful hot air balloon, 100 feet tall, with streamers hanging from the sides. A pilot standing in the wicker basket blasted flames into the canopy, and the balloon tugged at the lines, tethering it to the ground. Next to the wicker basket was a guy in a wheelchair who had steered it there with a straw. Carl wanted to do something amazing for us that he would never have the chance to experience himself. People who have developed a friendship with Jesus and are becoming love aren't immune to life setbacks. They have just as many as everyone else. Sometimes I wonder if they have a few more, but I haven't tried to count. People like Carl have found something many of us are still looking for. He knows he's neither defined nor limited by his circumstances. He sees power in his brokenness and the opportunities in the opposition he faces. Carl isn't stuck trying to figure out why this thing happened to him. He's too busy celebrating other people's lives and making things happen for them. People like Carl don't think about what they've lost. They think about what they'll do with what they still have, and the answer is much. In that field outside of San Diego, we stumbled our way into the hot air balloon basket. The lines holding us to the ground were untied, and after a couple of loud flame blasts, we began to float away. As we did, big things became small, and close things seemed far away. The experience was probably not a lot different than what might happen when we get to heaven and look down on our lives, because there will be no impediments nor limiting beliefs blocking our view anymore. Carl had given us the gift of a new perspective. It was the kind of worldview Carl had found long before, but we were just discovering through his beautiful life. We looked over the edge of the basket as we lifted into the sky and waved to Carl. He couldn't wave back, of course, but he didn't need to. Great love, expressing itself in the world, doesn't need any arm waving. It's always recognizable and leaves little doubt in the lives of the people it touches. Chapter 15, The Perimeter Wall. We need to guard our hearts. Many of you know I'm the honorary consul of Uganda to the United States. It's a long story how I got to be a diplomat for them, and I'm still not sure I even understand why they picked me. The job comes with some cool perks. I get small Ugandan flags to put on my pickup truck when I go somewhere. More than once, I thought it would be pretty neat to have some Secret Service agents run alongside the car on the way to the grocery store and have them fan out in the frozen food aisle and talk into their sleeves while I bought ice cream. I've gotten pulled over a couple times in my car, and the State Department card I have is amazing. It says I'm not subject to anyone's jurisdiction. How cool is that? Because I'm a consul, I find myself in Washington, D.C. fairly regularly. I go mainly to give people hugs and helium balloons, because Washington is usually short on both. If you want to practice loving people who creep you out, Washington, D.C. is a great place to start, because a lot of people there do creep me out. I know politics has a bad reputation, and it's well-deserved in many cases, but some of the people I know who work in government would blow you away with how well they love the men and women around them. As the years have gone by, my friendships with some of these amazing servants have deepened and grown. A few were serving one of our presidents during his two terms in office. So whenever I found myself in Washington, D.C., they'd be the first people I would give hugs to. On a trip several years ago, I called one of my friends to see if we could get together. He said his schedule was packed. Then, after a brief pause, he said he thought it could work. He asked if I wanted to tag along while he helped a friend propose to his girlfriend at the White House. A proposal at the White House? How could I say no to that? As a matter of fact, how could the girl say no? When I got to the White House, I met up with my buddy and another friend at the Northwest Gate. The guy with a ring in his pocket had already arrived with his girlfriend, who thought she was there for a tour. On the other side of security, as we were walking up to the entrance to the West Wing, a Secret Service guy stepped urgently around a corner, talking into his shirt sleeve. In a big, booming voice, he said, "Crash the White House." I've seen action movies where the White House gets attacked. When you hear "crash the White House," what usually follows is a flood of covert operatives with black smudges all over their faces. Machine gun fire is exchanged while foreign terrorists with British accents launch missiles. We froze as a dozen other Secret Service agents came out of nowhere. They emerged almost instantaneously from behind bushes and around office corners. I saw one guy step out of an oil painting. They all carried tough-looking machine guns and had one hand to their ear, listening to radio messages from each other. I touched my ear, too, trying to fit in. As this all unfolded, I was thinking two things. First, this is really bad. And second, this is really cool. They moved us inside the West Wing to wait while the Secret Service agents did their jobs. Apparently, moments earlier, a guy had thrown a bag over the fence surrounding the White House, jumped over the fence himself, and started running across the lawn towards the West Wing. Nobody ever said what was in the bag, but whatever it was, it had everyone on edge. There were a dozen snipers on the roof zeroed in on the guy running towards the White House. The 15 laser dots on his face probably made him look a lot like me in high school. Thankfully, they didn't shoot him, but he didn't get very far before he was tackled and taken away along with his bag. It was several hours before things at the White House settled down. I was hoping they would put us in the Situation Room or in the elevator that goes to a bunker somewhere. Instead, a Secret Service guy escorted us to a cafeteria on the bottom floor where the White House workers can get coffee or peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. The vice president walked past us, looked up from his watch and smiled. I thought I heard him ask, "Running mate?" as he passed. I was considering the offer when someone let me know and he had said, "Running late." I was so close. The poor guy who had come to propose to his girlfriend stood for a couple of hours sweating with a diamond ring in his pocket. He couldn't wait any longer. We made our way to some nearby stairs where he took a knee and asked her if she'd be his wife. She said yes and exploded into his arms. We never got to see the launch codes that afternoon, but watching this guy and his new fiancée was the next best thing. Since that day at the White House, I've had a visual of what it looks like to guard something very important. I saw how the White House put its best and strongest people in strategic spots to guard the perimeter. I saw how quickly they responded when possible danger got anywhere close. I noticed how they had a plan to make sure everyone inside was safe. I also saw their courage when they put themselves between us and any potential harm. The more I thought about it, the more our afternoon at the White House made me think about a guy in the Bible named Solomon. Solomon was an important character in the Bible and very smart. In fact, it said he was the smartest man to ever live. He was a humble man, too, and he was incredibly rich, which is a rare combination. Solomon could have had anything he wanted, power and prestige, mansions and chariots, land and horses and jewels, anything. However, one night God appeared to Solomon in a dream and invited him to ask for anything he wanted. Solomon told God he wanted one thing more than anything else, a discerning heart to lead his people well and to know the difference between right and wrong. That was it. He didn't want the fancy horses and carriages with the gold filigree. He wanted to lead in a way that would last. People who are becoming love bypass all the other stuff and start thinking about what would make a difference in the lives of the people around them. Because he was so humble, God gave Solomon what he asked for. The Bible says Solomon was given a wise and discerning heart, the kind of heart that would beat out everything else we could ever strive for. With his new heart, Solomon administered justice to the people he was over and became famous throughout the entire world for his wisdom. Kings from far and wide would come to him for advice. People from every country would trek to his place just to hear a few words from him. Solomon wrote all kinds of wise sayings and songs, which you can read in several books in the Bible. One of my favorite proverbs from Solomon, the wisest man on earth, reminds me what I learned at the White House with my friend. Solomon said this, "Above all else, the most important thing we can do is to guard our hearts." We may not have snipers on the roof and Secret Service agents in our backyards to help us. Nonetheless, we can be vigilant about who and what gets access to our lives and our hearts. What I think Solomon was getting at is this. If we guard our hearts the way I saw the Secret Service agents guard the White House, we'll live more meaningful, more purposeful, and less distracted lives. Guarding your heart doesn't mean keeping everything out, as if anything and everything could damage it. We don't need to become paranoid spiritual and relational hermits. It's actually the opposite. The people I see guarding their hearts well are not disengaged with life, but instead are wildly engaged in it. They give away love freely and take seriously Jesus' commands about loving people who are difficult. They don't run away from the people they wouldn't ordinarily like, and they certainly don't make enemies out of them. Guarding our hearts means defending our hearts from creeping indifference, protecting them from the fear of failure, and keeping them quick to hope and slow to judge. Guarding our hearts isn't just a nice idea from some guy who lived thousands of years ago. This was a big deal to the wisest man who ever lived. That definitely gets my attention. Many years ago, I was with a friend at a meeting. I was about to hand a microphone to someone when my friend leaned over and whispered to me, "Never let go of the microphone." I've thought about that statement a lot throughout the years. If we give the microphone away to someone else, it's not ours anymore. It's their microphone. This is fine, of course, if you want the person to have command over the room. But sometimes the person reaching for the microphone has a loose relationship with truth or affirmation or grace or time, or likes to showboat and tamp people down with big words. We've all been in more than one meeting, watching our clothes go out of style, waiting for the guy who had the microphone to finish talking and give it back. The whole time we were grimacing at what was being said and wondering why they got the microphone in the first place. Who have you been giving the microphone to in your life? It's a question worth asking. These days, I pass the microphone only to people who will speak words of truth and affirmation and hope into my life and the lives of the people around me. Don't get me wrong. I'm not looking for someone who will just blow sunshine at me and tell me what a swell guy I am. I just don't need someone who wants to beat me up or put others down with their words. I've never met a courageous cynic, and I don't listen to the loudest voice. I listen for the truest one. Guarding our hearts means being careful who we give the microphone to. I heard a saying once, and it goes like this. Weak point, pound the pulpit. Volume isn't a good substitute for content. I only raise my voice when I yodel, and I've never yodeled before. I tend to think if someone is yelling about something, it's not an idea compelling enough to believe as a whisper. We can believe in something without bellowing about it. Deeply held beliefs can be passionately shared without pegging the volume or putting someone else down. There are only a handful of things I can think that are worth yelling about. Love and grace and justice and forgiveness would be among them. Shout these things from every rooftop with your outdoor voice. Go horse talking about them, but never lose your voice. Save the rest of the decibels for cheering at hockey games. Guarding the hearts of the people around us doesn't mean we need to start holding everyone around us accountable either. I can't think of a single time where Jesus held someone accountable in the way we typically talk about it in our faith communities. He held people closely. People who want to hold everybody accountable aren't bad or mean. They probably just don't know what it feels like to be held closely. Because if you've experienced what it's like to be held close, you get both. I've heard a lot of people call one another brother or sister, but act like they're not related. It would be a shame if we were so busy guarding everyone else's hearts, we overlooked our own. People who are becoming love are picky about what they say and who they give the microphone to. Give yours to people who are better at holding you close than holding you accountable. Surround yourself with people who want to be your friend, not your parole officer. If you want to guard your heart constantly, hold your friends closely too. Do it often. Send them emails and text messages, letting them hear you're holding them close. Don't tell your friends what to do. Tell them who they are. If you want to guard their hearts, whisper words of truth and affirmation to them. If they've given you the microphone in their life, treat it like it's an honor and an opportunity, not an accident. Choose your words carefully. And if someone throws a bag of lies over the wall, you don't need to tackle the person. Just don't open the bag, and instead, go Solomon on them and guard your heart. Chapter 16, Land the Plane. God doesn't give us all the details because he trusts us. Each of us has a place that feels like heaven, a place where it's easier to sense God's creativity expressed in love and joy, mountains and streams. For my family and me, it's a lodge we built at the end of an inlet in British Columbia, Canada. It's a place where the waters of the Pacific are rimmed by 8,000-foot snow-capped mountains. A few times a year, killer whales bob slowly through the inlet, and you can hear them exhale across the glassy water. Untouched cedar forests are filled with trees that were saplings before cars were invented. The lodge is a dream more than 22 years in the making. It started with a couple of tents the first year, then eventually a lodge and surrounding buildings with enough beds for 70 people. It has become our place for restoration and adventure. God is somehow easier to find there. But with all of the beauty comes some small inconveniences. There are no roads for 100 miles in any direction. We make our own electricity off a glacier on the property, grow our own vegetables, and catch dinner in the ocean and rivers. Getting the things we need, like engine parts, is no small task. Taking a boat to this place is possible, but it's a long trip. So when I stumbled on an old de Havilland Beaver seaplane for sale, I knew it was the solution we needed. All I needed to learn was how to fly it. What could possibly go wrong? Beavers are guy planes. If they could make them out of beef jerky, they would. The 9-piston, 500-horsepower engine, called the Wasp Junior by the manufacturer, is junior to none and all steel and power. They stopped making these airplanes 60 years ago, so they're pretty frayed around the edges now. The way you know a Beaver engine is out of oil is when it stops leaking. The fuselage has an old-world craftsmanship to it. It's not made of sheet metal or prefab fiberglass. It's pure tough, and it looks like it could take some hits from heavy guns or bears or avalanches or preschool kids and keep going. It's the kind of plane Indiana Jones would fly out of a remote jungle. Actually, Harrison Ford owns a Beaver, and in a couple of movies, this actually happened. A Beaver has pontoons because it's made to land on the water instead of a runway. When we're at the lodge, I usually fly out every week or two and fill it up with things we need, like ice cream and Pop-Tarts, and fly back. Going to the lodge is something we count the days for in the Goff family. Every year as school winds down in late May, spring fever takes over on steroids. The house gets charged with planning and anticipation for the trek north for the summer. When our kids were in school, it was downright torturous. They'd be stuck in first period English, knowing in a few weeks they'd be skipping rocks next to 100-foot waterfalls and foraging for dinner. We try to get it to the lodge a different way each year. Richard graduated from high school, and we were looking for some adventure, so we bought some Harleys and Triumphs and rode motorcycles there. We started in Mexico and crossed North America, bottom to top. None of us had ever been on the highway with a motorcycle before. We figured we'd learn what we needed to know on the way. By the time we got to San Francisco, we could even change gears. Another year, Richard, who is definitely winsome, led us on an amazing adventure as we fixed up a 1971 Volkswagen bus. Richard drove it up to Canada, and he and Adam drove it back. Richard kept that bus for years and still leads us with creativity and laughter. Adam was going into his senior year of high school. He was normally a great student, really disciplined and focused. But at that point, high school just felt kind of over to him. He had most of what he needed to get into college, and the last year felt like a punishingly slow victory lap. One evening, close to the start of the school year, I asked to see Adam's class list. He went up to his room and was there for a long time. When he came back downstairs to the kitchen table where I was sitting, he stared at his feet as he reluctantly handed it over. I looked at the list from top to bottom and laughed. "Where's the classes?" He tried to hold back a grin, but didn't do a very good job. His class list was ridiculous. I don't remember exactly, but I think he was the hall monitor for one period, cleaned erasers for another, had an art class, and was working the school office for the rest of the day. This is the schedule of a guy with his feet up on the handlebars and his fingers woven together behind his head. Sure, I was sympathetic. Adam was beyond bored with school. Nothing really lit him up anymore. I remember the same thing happened to me in high school. Rather than coming down on Adam about his class list, we put our heads together and came up with a plan. What he needed was a challenge big enough to hold his attention for the year. I had him sign up for a few real classes, and we got rid of all the other time fillers. For his senior year, Adam would leave school at noon each day and head to the airport to get his pilot's license. Instead of coasting through his last year of high school, he would be riding it out at cruising altitude. Sweet Maria thought Adam flying an airplane every day was a terrible idea, particularly when she heard he would be flying it alone after only a couple weeks of lessons. I told Adam to think of his after-school program as a pass-fail class. You crash, you fail. Adam would come home every day and tell us about what he learned. He would describe the cockpit and the pre-flight checklist. His vocabulary was peppered with new terms like pitch and yaw. He was insistent about the process for buckling his seatbelt. I think he did this to show his mom he was taking the lesson seriously and wouldn't die. Our house wasn't just a home anymore. It was Top Gun school. By the end of the year, Adam got a diploma, a pilot's license, and a leather jacket, all in the space of a few days. He also got a seaplane rating so he could fly my Beaver. There are thousands of remote mountain lakes in British Columbia. These emerald lakes are scattered everywhere, isolated between steep granite walls of surrounding mountains. Whenever I fly over them, I size them up and wonder if they would be big enough to land on. For more than a decade, the boys and I have been eyeing one of these lakes. It freezes solid each winter and is covered by 10 feet of snow. But by the end of the summer, the snow and ice melt away, leaving a jaw-dropping alpine lake behind. The lake isn't large. From the air, it looks like no more than a curbside puddle after a rainstorm. Each time we would fly over the lake, we would nudge each other and wonder out loud whether there was enough lake to land the Beaver, and if we did, would there be enough room to get back out again? The entry point for the Beaver is a tight squeeze between two towering granite walls. If you make it through, the lake is at the bottom of a 2,000-foot ravine. Getting there requires an aggressive descent. Each step requires total commitment because the ravine and the deep bowl containing the lake are too cramped to turn around midway. Once you're in, there's no option but to land the plane and prepare for a new takeoff going the other direction. It's a round-trip ticket made of two one-way tickets. One day, Adam and I were flying the Beaver back from a grocery run to town. As we passed over the lake, I looked over and asked, "What if we land in the lake today?" Adam laughed it off nervously. "No, I'm serious. Let's do it." Adam stared at me for a long moment, wondering if I meant it. I took that as a yes and dipped the wing towards the lake and we started descending. The cockpit became charged with an intense mixture of fear and excitement. We leveled the wings a few thousand feet over the lake and started the approach. The entry point was as narrow as it looked from the air. We were reaching the point where we couldn't turn around or pull out. I looked next to me and Adam had a steely-eyed resolve as he looked through the windshield. We entered between the mountains and immediately things got much louder. The engine roar bounced off both granite walls and flooded the cockpit with noise. I looked out both side windows to get a visual of my orientation of the rock walls on either side. The wing was a safe but short distance from the granite wall on the right, and I was confident as we navigated this part of the approach. Next, we would descend to the lake. As soon as we cleared the entrance, I pushed the controls forward. Before, we were looking at the mountains straight ahead. Now we were looking mainly at the water as we flew the length of the lake. I was stunned to see how beautiful it looked, but quickly shook that off. No time for sightseeing. Adam's eyes were big enough to take it in for both of us. Even though we were making a sharp descent, we didn't have enough room to land the Beaver straight in. At the end of the lake, there was a widening of the rocks just big enough for a final descending turn. It was a tight area to maneuver, but it was doable. I got as close as I could to the rock wall at the end of the lake and rolled the plane's wing one more time. We weren't perpendicular to the water, but it felt like it. I pushed the yoke all the way forward this time to descend the last 400 feet to the lake. Once you make that last turn, dropping the last few hundred feet needs to happen in a hurry, but with a lot of care. If you land short, you hit the rocks. If you go long, you hit the trees. If you've ever seen a pelican dive bomb to catch a sardine, it was a lot like that, but with more grace and less fish. After going down the elevator pretty fast, we flattened our descent just a foot or two over the water, flared, and set the plane down. The pontoon skimmed across the alpine water and settled in. We slowed to the stop and I cut the engine and unpeeled my hands from the controls. Adam and I sat silently for a couple of seconds, staring out the front of the plane. Then we looked at each other and huge grins ripped across both of our faces. "We did it! We landed in the lake!" we yelled into the silence as we high-fived in the cockpit. After all of those years and looking and wondering if it could be done, now we had the answer. But that was only half the equation. We still needed to answer the other half. Was there enough lake for us to get out? I could see Adam's mind grinding out the possibilities and what he would do, so I turned to look at him. "Okay, Adam, you fly us out of here." He shook his head violently, like a Labrador retriever with water in his ears. "No way." He had a stern look in him like he meant business, but I did too. While he was protesting, I unbuckled myself, got out of the pilot seat, and moved to a back passenger seat to make way for the new pilot. There was only one other place to sit, so Adam snapped into the pilot seat, gripped the controls, and just stared. It was game on. Adam taxied the plane all the way back to the weeds at the far end of the lake. He was setting up the plane like a sprinter putting his feet into the starting blocks. A beaver needs to be going 52 miles an hour before it will lift off the water. If you try to take off when you're only going 48 miles an hour, the pontoon floats will dig into the water and slow you down, and you'll run out of lake and hit the trees. If you wait until you're going 70 miles per hour, you'll run out of lake and hit the trees. Adam knew the stakes, and I reminded him to keep his eye on the speed, because what he did would determine where we'd be spending the next few days. We would need every inch of lake to get up and over the trees at the far end. Sometimes prayers are spoken, and other times they're just said in our actions. Adam put his hands on the controls and threw in all the throttle. I said amen. I had one eye on the speedometer as the plane picked up speed. Adam got us to 30 and then 40 miles per hour. The plane skipped across the surface like a ski boat. He kept increasing the speed while the trees on the other end kept getting bigger in the windshield. When the plane passed 52 miles per hour, I started anticipating liftoff. Adam knew what to do to get us off the water. Adam pulled back before we ran out of lake, and we cleared the top of the trees as we sailed out of the canyon. Eat your heart out, Indiana Jones. Adam let out a big yelp, and I was woo-hooing. I was going to give him a chest bump, but figured we'd crash, so I didn't. The lake was disappearing behind us as we flew back towards the lodge, all grins. I bet Adam was working on the story we would tell everyone when we got there. I turned to Adam again and said, "Okay, turn the plane around and let's see if you can land us back in the lake." Adam started shaking his head again so hard I thought it might fall off. We had a good enough story, right? Then I saw him mentally switch and he started to turn the plane. When Adam entered the canyon, I didn't say anything. When he started descending into the canyon, I didn't say anything. When he made his turn at the wide spot at the end of the lake, he nailed it. I didn't say anything. As we made the final descent toward the lake, Adam threw the yoke forward. We were still 50 feet off the water when he flew past where I had landed previously. I didn't say anything. Adam landed the plane like a boss, and we came to a stop. Adam had flown into the canyon as an 18-year-old, but when the beaver touched down on the water, he looked 35. I looked like I was 120. The whole time all of this was happening, I was thinking this: land the plane. God isn't always leading us to the safest route forward, but to the one where we'll grow the most. I knew Adam well enough to know he could land the plane. I'd seen him do it 100 times in more open waters. I had already told him everything I knew about it. He didn't need more instruction. He just needed to see I believed in him enough to let him do it. He didn't need more words or to know what they meant in Greek or Hebrew. He just needed an opportunity. The people who have shaped my faith the most did the same for me. They didn't try to teach me anything. They let me know that they trusted me. And that taught me everything. Those moments are forever etched into who I am. I think God does the same with us. I've heard a lot of people say they wish they could hear from God about this or that. Maybe they mean they want to hear his audible voice. I'm not sure. I don't think literally hearing something is what most of us are after. What we actually want is an extra nudge of confidence from God and the opportunity to move forward courageously to do those things we already know how to do. What a shame it would be if we've been waiting for God to say something while he's been waiting on us to do something. He speaks to me the loudest on the way. Simply put, if we want more faith, we need to do more stuff. Part of me really understands people's hesitation. There have been times when I've wanted to hear God's voice, particularly when something really big mattered to me. The sad truth is, I'm often making too much racket to hear him. He won't try to shout over all the noise in our lives to get our attention. He speaks most clearly in the stillness desperation brings. I've also come to see the purpose and beauty in God's silence. It's like he's telling me he knows my heart's desire and what I'm thinking. He knows what he's taught me. He's seen when I've succeeded and when I've failed. From his point of view, that all rolls up into an unspoken whisper from him. I can almost hear him saying, "You've got this." His biggest priority isn't removing failure as an option, but reminding me he loves me as I try. There's a verse in the Bible that says, "Do not despise these small beginnings." I love that. It's a reminder to me God doesn't just value the big endeavors that work, and he isn't afraid we'll fail. Instead, he delights in our attempts. God knows we won't do everything picture perfect either. If we're being honest, our mess-ups outnumber our successes, probably by a wide margin. More than once, I've been a little too close to the rocks and a little out of position. I've come in a little hot, gone a little long, or fallen a little short in the things I've attempted. But God hasn't been shouting instructions to me as I've made mistakes, because he doesn't need to. His silence isn't indifference, it's engagement. He isn't quiet because he's run out of things to say or is scared about the outcome. It's because he already believes in me just as much as he knows the outcome. He already believes in you, too. He's so confident we already know what to do next, he's willing to be silent even when we ask for his voice. He doesn't care as much as we do whether we perform perfectly or not. He just wants us to be his while we do it. Most of us don't need more instructions. We simply need someone who believes in us. If we're fortunate, God will surround us with friends who know us so well they've stopped trying to control our conduct with endless instructions, and instead, trust that God is at work in our lives, even when he's doing things we don't yet understand. It's perfectly normal and okay to feel afraid and confused and stationary. It happens to all of us at one time or another. We shouldn't be surprised when we don't understand what a God who says he surpasses all understanding is doing. God doesn't want us to get stuck scratching our heads or overanalyzing our circumstances. He doesn't send in all the plays to get us out of our funk, and he doesn't carpet bomb us with instructions about what to do next. Instead, he continues to be with us. He's not entirely silent when he is either. He sent us books about him, and he's included a lot of letters. He sent us friends, too. He's given us successes and failures, plenty of both. He's written things on our hearts like love and grace and patience and compassion, so we can write these things on the hearts of our friends. We're God's calligraphy. He doesn't do this so our words will look better, but because he sees the beauty in our lives. When we dream up something where the outcome seems uncertain and we don't hear God's voice, what if God isn't saying anything to us because he's already said it? Like my time with Adam flying into the lake, I can picture God sitting beside each of us, not confused or afraid, but confident we have all the information we need. We may not have had the experience with the circumstance we're presently facing, but he's allowed us to experience a lifetime of other things to prepare us for what's coming next. He knows that without risk we can't grow. God didn't promise us a safe life. Instead, he said he would give us a dangerous, courageous, and purposeful one if we'll take him at his word and stay engaged. Sometimes God is confidently quiet. He doesn't give us more explanations. He knows we don't need more words of instruction. The moment we take even a tiny shuffle forward, what God is already thinking about us is this: I love you. You've got this. You know enough. Now go land the plane. Chapter 17, A Welcome from Walter. What we do with our love will become the conversations we have with God. I have a friend named Walter. After the government was overthrown in his country, he escaped from a jail in a hail of bullets and fled to the United States for safety. Now, Walter helps people resettle here after they've been forced from their homes in other countries. Many of them arrive at airports in the United States, straight from United Nations refugee camps overseas. They step off the plane having experienced years of hunger and thirst, displacement and fear. Confused, scared, lonely, they come as strangers to this new place. They don't stop at baggage claim for luggage,